welcome to WGXC 90.7, Acra Hudson Catskill, and this month's edition of The Score, where we listen and discuss film and television soundtracks and scores. I am Lisa Thomas.
And I am Margot Pelletier.
And we are your hosts. At the top of the show, you heard the song Goodbye for Now, music by Stephen Sondheim, and performed by Jean-Pierre Rampel and Claude Bolling.
Today, as I mentioned earlier, we will be listening to the score and soundtrack of Warren Beatty's 1981 epic film, Reds. The film recalls the short adult life of American journalist John Reed, played by Warren Beatty. And it also recalls Reed's impassioned love of the Russian Revolution, a revolution that he saw as a hopeful catalyst for the American workers and all the workers throughout the world toward winning the power of self-determining their own lives and toward building a just world. Beatty assembled an amazing cast, including Diane Keaton, who played his love interest, Louise Bryant, Jack Nicholson, who played the writer Eugene O'Neill, and Maureen Stapleton, who played the steeled anarchist Emma Goldman.
Was that 1913 or 17? I can't remember now. I'm beginning to forget all the people that I used to know, see?
Do I remember Louise Bryan? Why, of course, I couldn't forget her if I tried.
I can't. I might sort of scratch my memory, but not at the moment. You know, things go and come back again.
It was Christopher Street, and I was thinking about another street down there instead until it came back that it was Christopher Street. And sometimes I have lapses like that.
I've forgotten all about them. Were they socialists? I guess they must have been, but I don't think they were of any importance. I don't remember them at all.
I know that Jack went around with Mabel Dodge, and then he went around with another gal, and then he went around with Louise Bryant. I know there were shifts back and forth, but it never occurred to me to never impinged on my own personal life. I like baseball.
I don't know what the outside world thought of them, but they were a couple. I mean, you always spoke of Louise Bryant and Jack Reed.
Yeah, I recall his telling me that he had two ambitions when he came to college. One was to be elected president of his class. He didn't know anyone in the class, no one knew him. The other was to make $1 million by the time he was 25.
Now, my idea about Jack Reed is probably different from most, but I knew him well. I knew he was a man of strong views. I knew he was independent. And I have an idea, I may be wrong in this, that his wife was a communist. And that his wife had influenced him, as any wife does, as you know, and I know.
Louise Bryant? Well, I thought she was something of an exhibitionist.
No, I'm not going to talk about people. Don't fool yourself. No, sir. I'm not a purveyor of neighborhood gossip or anything of the kind. That's not my job.
He was quiet. He was a nice fellow. I would say if I met him, I would say he was nice. He was, however, a fighting fellow in regard to principles.
I said, I think, that a guy who is always interested in the condition of the world and changing it either has no problems of his own or refuses to face them.
Jack, well, I wouldn't call him a playboy, but some people did.
Jack Reed's life, short as it was, happened at a time, and all of us, after all, are the victims of our time and place, when he had the opportunity as a reporter to be in some very exciting and dramatic places.
Didn't everybody can be buried in the Kremlin? And he's the only American born in Portland, Oregon, buried in the Kremlin.
Now, isn't that something?
Jack Reed, as many of you know, was the author of the book 10 Days That Shook the World, a book that chronicles the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution is a collective term referring to several uprisings and takeovers in Russia between 1917 and 1922.
Ultimately, Reed, who was an eyewitness to the several shifts in power in Russia throughout this time period, was forced to swallow a fair share of disillusionment within his utopian view of the struggle. Reed died at the young age of 33 in a hospital in Russia, having been reunited with the writer Louise Bryant, who, after leaving her upper-class husband, became Reed's lover, his wife, and ultimately his comrade. You just heard I Don't Want to Play in Your Yard from the 1981 film soundtrack Reds. Warren Beatty co-wrote, produced, and directed the film Reds, which was released in December of 1981, 33 years ago from now. The film became the highest-grossing picture of that year, grossing $50 million in the United States alone. This is all the more interesting considering that Ronald Reagan had just become president and the country was moving towards greater conservatism and eventual Reaganomics. With our country's history of fear of the Soviet Union and of communism in general, it seems that Warren Beatty was perhaps the only person who could have gotten a green light on a film with this subject matter made in Hollywood at the time. After a streak of successful hits, Beatty used his popularity and power with studio executives at Paramount to push through a film he had been trying to develop for over a decade. Beatty actually came across the story of George Reed in the mid-1960s, and then he started talking about a film about Reed by about 66. Beatty wrote the first script for the film, and then eventually he joined forces with screenwriter Trevor Griffins in 76 in what has been described as a totally gruesome process. The script was finished by 78, and the principal photography began in 1979. The film was shot over a year's time, which to some of us doesn't seem like a long time, but in film terms, it's an enormous amount of time. They shot it in five different countries, and Beatty proved to be a relentless director, asking for excessive amounts of takes. Actually, at one point, he asked for 80 takes of one scene. At the time, he was actually in an off-camera relationship with Diane Keaton, and it did end with her finally being fed up with his compulsiveness and his insensitivity, and she actually walked off the set after her final scene.
That's good, because I read the ambulance piece, and I thought that was good.
Thank you.
And I know you're working on your book, and I know how important that is to you. But you got to have enough sense if you're trying to build up your reputation as a journalist to be in the right place at the right time.
I appreciate you.
Well, the place to be now is Russia.
Oh, thank you. I'll remember that.
Louise, it's chaos. It can't last. They're on their third provisional government in 6 months. Do you know what that means? It means there might be another revolution. The workers are deserting the factories, the army is deserting the battlefronts, the exiles are all coming back, the Jews, the anarchists, the socialists, all of them are going back, only this time, it might be the real thing. And if they have a real workers' revolution in Russia, they'd have one in Germany. And if they had one in Germany, it could happen all over the world.
Sky match?
Louise, that'd be the end of the war.
You don't have to tell me what's happening in Russia. I read the papers.
Well, come with me. As a colleague, I'm not talking about anything else. Come with me as a colleague. You ought to be in Petrograd.
Oh, yeah? Well, that's what you said about New York.
I was right about
New York. No, I have work I'm doing here, and I happen to think my work is important.
It is important, but it's not as important as what you could be doing in Russia. I want to work together as partners.
I don't want a partner, and if I wanted to go to Russia, I'd go alone. I wouldn't need you to take me.
Louise, Russia is not the safest place in the world for a woman to be alone. You may be a hell of a journalist, but that doesn't mean...
Yes, I've been promised an interview with General Plumer. Sorry, I don't have any time.
Yeah, no, I don't want to keep you. Just, look, the seat's already destroyed.
You're wasting your money, Jack. I don't want it.
Change the date. Go by yourself. You can use it whenever you want. Keep up the good work.
Jack? Good luck.
Yeah, you too.
Excuse me. Now, here's the thing. I'd be a goddamn fool not to take you up on this offer, so here's what I want. I want to sign my own name to my own stories, and I don't want to use a double byline. I want to be responsible for my own time and my own actions. I want to be referred to as Miss Bryant, not Mrs. Reed, and I want to keep an account of every cent we spend so that I can pay you back. Now, I assume you know that I'm not going to sleep with you, so just don't confuse the issue by bringing it up. That's it.
Fine.
Good.
Editing for Reds began in the late spring of 1980 with an unprecedented 65 people working on the editorial staff. The team had the daunting task of cutting down 2.5 million feet of film shot. Some in the industry joked that every employable editor in New York City was working on Reds in the spring of 1980. The film cost $33.5 million, which would be the equivalent of roughly $80 million today.
While the process of creating Reds was long and burdened with Beatty's often cruel perfectionism, in June of 2008, the American Film Institute revealed its 10 top 10, the best films in the 10 classic American genres, after polling over 15,000 people from the creative community, Reds was acknowledged as the 9th best film in the epic genre.
Then comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The International unites the human race. Then comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The International unites the human race. That's how it goes.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to WGXC 90.7 and this month's edition of The Score, where today we are featuring the music to the 1981 epic docudrama film Reds. You just heard the song Internazionale, performed by the Moscow Radio Chorus. The film score was composed by the American composers Stephen Sondheim and Dave Grusin. Grusin was born in 1934 in Littleton, Colorado, and studied at the University of Colorado College of Music at Boulder. Both Grusin's parents were musicians. His mother, Rosabelle, was a pianist, and his father, Henry, was a violinist, and they immigrated from Riga, Latvia.
Grusin's first film score was for Divorce American Style, and that was in 1967. Some of his many film scores are 3 Days of the Condor, The Graduate, On Golden Pond, Tootsie, The Firm, the list just goes on and on. Grusin's filmography is about 100 titles long. His awards include an Oscar for the Best Original Score for the Milagro Beanfield Award. Grusin formed GPP Records in the late 70s with Larry Rosen. Grusin and Rosen began to create some of the first commercial digital recordings. Dave Grusin was the conductor for the Andy Williams television show. I thought that was very interesting. And that was from, 63 to 65. He also scored a lot of other theme songs for television, including It Takes a Thief.
Here are a few tracks from David Grusin now from the film soundtrack to Reds, so enjoy.
You in Chicago with Jack?
Why should I be? He has his things, I have mine.
What are they?
What?
The things that you have that are yours. What are they?
My work, for one.
He's a real mean son of a bitch, isn't he?
What do you mean?
leaving you alone with your work.
You think I mind?
You should. It's the one thing we mustn't be left alone with.
You may feel that way, I don't.
Good. Don't let those village radicals keep you from being what you should be.
What do you think I should be?
The center of attention.
Well, you must have been with some very competitive women.
Let's just say possessive.
Possessive? That's something else. It's a waste of time. I'm not. Neither is Jack, for that matter.
Oh, yes. I know. You and Jack have your own thing.
He has the freedom to do the things that he wants to, and so do I. And I think anyone who's afraid of that kind of freedom is really only afraid of his own emptiness.
Are you making this up as you go along?
Like you go.
Why?
Because I don't want to be patronized. I'm sorry if you don't believe in mutual independence and free love and respect.
Give me a lot of parlor socialism that you learned in the village. If you were mine, I wouldn't share you with anybody or anything. It would be just you and me. You'd be at the center of it all. You know, it would feel a lot more like love than being left alone with your work.
That was Comrades, New York Waltz, and Bloody Border, composed by David Grusin for the 1981 film Reds, followed by a soundbite from the film where Eugene O'Neill, played by Jack Nicholson, tells Louise Bryant, played by Diane Keaton, just how he feels about her.
According to an article in the Vanity Fair in 2006, written by Peter Biskind, Beatty tricked Nicholson into accepting the smallish but important part of Eugene O'Neill in the film by asking Nicholson's advice on who Beatty could cast that would convincingly steal Louise Bryant away from him. Without missing a beat, Nicholson responded, "Well, there's only one actor who could do that, and that's me."
Comminterns, they know me. Somebody's got to go over there who's got a background. We'll be back by Christmas. The foreign language federations aren't going to create Bolshevism in America any more than eating borscht will. Being Russian doesn't make a revolution. Do you think the American worker is going to be led by the Russian federations or an insular Italian like Louis Freyna? He has no possibility of leading a revolution in this country.
Unlike you?
I'm just saying that the revolution in this country is not going to be led by immigrants.
Revolution? In this country? When, Jack? Just after Christmas?
Well, what do you think we could have done with a steel strike if we'd been ready? 30,000 party members, all armed with a unified theory and program, leaving 365,000 steel workers. What it takes is leadership, and we gotta get it by getting recognition from Moscow. I have to go.
You don't have to go. You want to go. You want to go running all over the world, ranting and raving and making resolutions and organizing caucuses. What's the difference between the Communist Party and the Communist Labor Party, except that you're running one and he's running the other?
I've made a commitment.
To what? To the fine distinction between which half of the left is recognized by Moscow as the real Communist Party in America? To petty political squabbling between humorless and hack politicians just wasting their time on left-wing dogma? To getting the endorsement of a committee in Russia you call the International for your group of 14 intellectual friends in the basement who are supposed to tell the workers of this country what they want, whether they want it or not? Right, Jack. You're not a politician, you're a writer. And your writing has done more for the revolution than 20 years of this infighting could do, and you know it. You're an artist, Jack.
You just heard The Red Army is the Most Powerful of All, performed by the Moscow Radio Chorus, followed by another soundbite from the 1981 epic film Reds.
One of the things that we discovered about Warren Beatty, and is perhaps a possible connection to why Beatty delved so deeply into a film whose subject matter focused largely on the forgotten American left in the years before, during, and after World War I, is that a relative on Beatty's mother's side was the last sitting communist member of the Canadian Parliament. And we were wondering how much discussion may have gone on in their household about politics, and in particular, leftist politics, while he was growing up.
down. What can I do for you?
Hello, Jean. How are you?
Fine. And you?
I'm fine.
How's Jack?
Oh, he's fine. He's in Russia.
Is he?
Yes, he's trying to get recognition from the Comintern for the Communist Labor Party. You see, they split into two different factions.
And you? Left alone with your work again?
No. Well, actually, yes, but my work is different now. I do a lot of lecturing about what I saw in Russia.
Ah, yes, Russia. Russia's been good for you and Jack. Giving you a way to meet people, giving him a reason to leave home. Russia. Russia.
Are you really that cynical, or are you angry with me?
I'm really that cynical. Why would I be angry with you?
Jean, if you'd been to Russia, you'd never be cynical about anything again. You would have seen people transformed, ordinary people.
Something in me tightens when an American intellectual's eyes shine and they start to talk to me about the Russian people.
Wait.
Something in me says, watch it. A new version of Irish Catholicism is being offered for your faith. And I wonder why a lovely wife like Louise Reed, who's just seen the brave new world, is sitting around with a cynical bastard like me, instead of trotting all over Russia with her idealistic husband. It's almost worth being converted.
Well, I was wrong to come.
You and Jack have a lot of middle-class dreams for two radicals. Jack dreams that he can hustle the American working man, whose one dream is to be rich enough not to have to work, into a revolution led by his party. And you dream that if you discuss the revolution with a man before you go to bed with him, it'll be missionary work rather than sex. I'm sorry to see you and Jack so serious about your sports. It's particularly disappointing in you, Louise. You had a lighter touch when you were touting free love.
Well, you've become quite the critic, haven't you, Jean? Just leaned back and analyzed us all. Duplicitous women who tout free love and then get married, power-mad journalists who join the revolution instead of observing it, middle-class radicals who come looking for sex and then talk about Russia. It must seem so contemptible to a man like you who has the courage to sit on his ass and observe human inadequacy from the inside of a bottle. Well, I've never seen you do anything for anyone. I've never seen you give anything to anyone, so I can understand why you might suspect the motives of those who have. But whatever Jack's motives are, how...
seem to have touched a wound.
And whatever I've done to you, you've made me pay for it.
You just heard Comrades performed, or composed rather, by David Grusin, followed by The Engine performed by the Moscow Radio Chorus, and a soundbite from the film Reds. Now, Stephen Sondheim also composed a few of the tracks within the soundtrack, and we're going to tell you a little bit about his history. Stephen Sondheim was born on March 22nd in 1930. His compositions and lyrics have contributed to musical theater and film for over 50 years, landing him, among numerous other awards, a Tony Award for Lifetime Achievement in Theater. As composer and lyricist, his most famous works include A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Sunday in the Park with George, and Into the Woods. He also wrote the lyrics for West Side Story and Gypsy.
While Stephen's childhood was very privileged in terms of opportunities and schooling, in many ways it was lonely and barren. He was the only child of a wealthy dress manufacturer, his father, who actually left the family when Stephen was 10, and of a dress designer mother, who in his own words was either rejecting him or coming on to him. An early yearning for human connection may have helped develop his ability to convey human emotions through song lyrics. The music producer Cameron McIntosh has said of Stephen, "He is possibly the greatest lyricist ever."
At the age of 10, Sondheim became friends with James Hammerstein, the son of lyricist and playwright Oscar Hammerstein II, Hammerstein became a surrogate father to Stephen and is the man who inspired a love for musical theater in Stephen. Hammerstein proved to be a tough but effective mentor, and while attending George School in Pennsylvania, Sondheim wrote his first musical. It was called By George. Hammerstein tore it apart and then assigned Stephen a four-part assignment with various instructions. The assignment led to the creation of four original musicals.
Eventually, Sondheim enrolled in Williams College in Williamstown, Mass., in their theater department, under the teacher Robert Barrow. I wanted to read a quote by Stephen about studying with Barrow, but beyond that, a quote that I find comforting and inspiring. Sondheim, referring to Robert Barrow, says, "Everybody hated him because he was dry, and I thought he was wonderful because he was dry. And Barrow made me realize that all my romantic views of art were nonsense. I've always thought that an angel came down and sat on your shoulder and whispered in your ear, da 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 dum. It never occurred to me that art was something worked out. And suddenly it was like the skies opened up. As soon as you find a leading tone, it's like you think, oh my God. And then you find a diatonic scale and it's, oh my God, the logic of it. And of course, what this all meant to me was, well, I can do that because you just don't know. You think it's talent. You think you're born with this thing. But what I found out and what I believe is that everybody is talented. It's just that some people get to develop it and some don't."
We have one more track coming up for you, which was composed by Sondheim. But before we end our show today, we usually go out with Margot's parting words, but she gave us that lovely quote just there here at The Score. But today we would like the witnesses to the life of Jack Reed and Louise Bryant to take us out. So,
until next month, be good to yourselves, be better to your neighbors, and before you do anything, make sure you know The Score.
It was in the afternoon, sometime in the fall, I think, October, I think. Somebody came to tell me that Jack Reed died. You can imagine. How I felt.
I've forgotten all about him. Were they socialists? Many of them were idealists. You know, things go and come back again.
I don't know what the outside world thought of them, but they were a couple. I mean, you always spoke of Louise Bryant and Jack Reed.
He was just a man in the prime of life. I don't even know, did they ever have any children? Their families didn't have any children, Ian and Louise. Again, you can't tell when you have children whether they will carry on your revolutionary tradition or not.
Why did he do it? Well, it's impossible to say why Edison invented or why Galacorchi sang. He was definitely a stirrer up of people. That was his field. That's what he came to do.
He's well known amongst a few, but not everybody. They don't know who in the heck he is. I look for myself to die any day.
I was asked by one, and I knew an American. I said, yes. And then he said, an American, American?
Of course, nobody goes with the idea of dying. Everybody wants to live. I don't remember his exact words, but the meaning was that that grand things are ahead, worth living and worth dying for. He himself said that.